Well, let me just say first thing, I feel a whole lot better than I sound, but we will get through this together. I'm sorry, you're dealing with some graveliness against your eardrums. I'm sure you know this story about a small town where a storm descended and a downpour soon turns into a flood. And as the waters rise, there's a local preacher who's kneeling in prayer on the front porch of his church and is surrounded by water. By and by, one of the town folks comes by in a canoe and says, "Better get in, preacher. The water is rising fast." "No," says the preacher, "I have faith in the Lord. He will save me." Still, the waters were rising, and the preacher had to move up to the balcony. And as he did, a guy zips by in a motorboat, and this guy says, "Come on in, preacher, we need to get you out of here." And the preacher says, "No, Lord willing, he'll see me through this, he'll save me." I said, "Okay." The waters rose even higher, and so the preacher had to climb all the way up to the steeple of the church here, and eventually a helicopter descends from the clouds, and there's a National Guardsman who yells down and says, "Grab the ladder, preacher, this is your last chance." And once again, the preacher insists, "The Lord's going to deliver me. Don't worry about it. Thank you." Now, predictably, he drowns. This pious man goes to heaven and finally has an interview with God. And he says, "Lord, I had unwavering faith in you. Why didn't you deliver me from that flood?" God just shakes his head and says, "What did you want from me? I sent you two boats and a helicopter." Depending on God is something that we oftentimes get wrong. And it seems like this modern day parable that we so love, that we do so willfully at times. It's not entirely by accident that we get this wrong so often, depending on God. It's a little bit uncomfortable of a parable because, in fact, today, a parable like this calls out our fiercely independent spirit. Of course, we're a country that every year celebrates Independence Day. We are a country that is also independent and lonely, even in the midst of unparalleled connection. We have independent living facilities that are oftentimes not in the best of shape and are places where too often we send our family members and leave them to be independent. Independent Christianity has splintered into thousands and thousands of denominations around the globe. And when we push away from another denomination because we don't like it, we leave just enough space for abuses such as the prosperity gospel or other abuses to well up. We are, in fact, I think, a fiercely independent-minded people. And a parable like this one makes us a little bit uncomfortable in our independence. Our gospel story today shows us that the dependent life is the powerful life. So we're going to look at the temptations of Jesus here. We're going to look at what the showdown is. There's a showdown. We're going to look at what the wrong, right solution is, and then what our path forward is from this story. Let's look at the showdown. So the gospel writer Luke definitely sets up this story as a battle. It is a battle, not just between Jesus and the devil, but a battle between the Holy Spirit active in Jesus and the devil whispering to Jesus. But let's look at these two folks who are in the ring here. In one corner, there's Jesus, who's just heard clouds parting, "You are my beloved son, with you I am well pleased." That's what's happened just before this scene. This is God's son who's been taken into the wilderness to be tempted. He's not Superman, though. I think this is helpful to remember because we tend to think that Jesus was just impervious as he walked through his life. Bullets would bounce off of him. He just bats them away. and that these temptations, like bullets off of Superman, are nothing to him. Absolutely not. Hebrews chapter 4 says, we do not have a high priest, Jesus, who is unable to empathize with our weakness. We have one who has been tempted in every way. He feels temptation just as we do. And he is full of the Holy Spirit here. That means Jesus walks into this scene, is even led into this scene by the power and the presence of God. Son of God, full of the Spirit, not Superman. One thing that we also learn about Jesus in our passage is that he is human. I don't know if you know, the reason we have two candles on our altar is to represent every Sunday before us both the full humanity and the full divinity of Jesus. He is fully both. The math doesn't add up, but that's a God thing. Jesus is fully human. I love this line in our story. Luke says, after 40 days of fasting, he was hungry. Of course he's hungry. But you got to think, we talked last week about how intentional Luke is about his writing. Why would he put a line like that in there? He's reminding us, Jesus is human. There was, in fact, a heresy at the time called Docetism that said that Jesus was really just kind of a shadowy version of a human. He looked human, but not really. I think that's more comfortable sometimes to us to think, well, my humanity and his humanity are totally different. Fully human. We'll talk more about that here in just a moment. But what we need to see is that Luke makes it clear that Jesus is fully God, and he is fully human, and he is hungry. So this first temptation that Satan brings his way has real bearing on him. So that's Jesus in one corner. We have the devil in the other corner. The literal Greek word diabolos. Luke uses it interchangeably with the name Satan. Many of us tend to want to call the devil just a personification of all of our evil choices in the world. Not a real person, just somebody that we put a name to. It's really just our choices that we can make or not. Luke doesn't let us get away with that. The devil is a real being who is really against God, good, this world, you. My favorite Bible interpreter, N.T. Wright, says, the Satan, it seems, is a non-human being, a type of angel, perhaps in some accounts, an ex-angel or fallen angel, and he or it is opposed not only to humankind, to Israel and to Jesus, but to creation itself. This is a real being that we have to grapple with. But what do we do with this? Look at the name. What's in a name? Diabolos. Literally, two Greek words, dia, baleo, through throwing. In other words, a kind of splitting apart, a rough splitting apart. He is also called the accuser, the slanderer, the shamer. These are his tools to split apart. Satan is, one nickname, the splitter in this way. What is he splitting? Particularly, humanity from the God that we were made for. In our previous town, Greenville, I chopped wood for the first time. I knew nothing about chopping wood. I grew up a city boy, so I knew I needed an axe. I knew that much. I didn't know what kind of axe. I didn't know there were kinds of axes. So I got one that had a wedge on it, finally, because I asked somebody at Lowe's, what kind of axe do you need for chopping wood? Here it is. I brought it home. We had all these, you know, big rounds of wood because there were all kinds of trees around our property that had been taken down. I said, we can use that for firewood. So I go to make my first swing, and I think, I don't really know where to hit this thing. So I lay it on its side, and I'm kind of whacking it on its bark, and that didn't do anything. And so I kind of sit it up so that the flat part's here, and I take a big swing and hit it right in the middle. And nothing except a stuck axe. So I took a long time to get the axe out of the wood. And I finally thought, well, okay, I see all these grooves in this going towards the center. I think I need to hit along one of these grooves to get this wood to split. I'm going to hit it right on the edge. This looks right. I take a big swing and a miss. I'm about 2 inches away from my toe. I finally recalibrate, take a swing, hit it on the edge of this round of wood. Splits easily. Satan is finding that perfect spot constantly to work his splitting. C.S. Lewis puts it this way: it does not matter how small the sins are, provided that their cumulative effect is to edge the man away from the light and out into nothing. He is constantly, bit by bit, finding those little grooves, those little temptations to split us, put a wedge just a little bit more from the God who we're created for. Satan's goal, driving a wedge between us and God. So this is the showdown. Jesus, fully God, fully human, the devil, working his way constantly between humanity and God. Let's look at the setting. What's happening here? Jesus is driven out into the wilderness for testing, for being tempted. This underlying word, peirazo, can mean a handful of things. Hannah mentioned on Ash Wednesday that this isn't just temptation like I gave in to the temptation for a second piece of birthday cake earlier this week. That's not what we're talking about. This is kind of a refining, right? Almost a metallurgic kind of understanding. Intense heat to purify a metal. It's also kind of this understanding that you see when you see an Olympian biting on their gold medal, right? Kind of making sure that it's really gold. I don't know what that would taste like. I don't know how they would know if it's really gold or not, but that's what they do. They're testing it in the same kind of way, making sure that it is what it should really be. Yes, even Jesus in his faith had to be refined. Even he had to learn about himself, what his calling was along the way. And even he had temptations along the way. Little moments where Satan wanted to drive a wedge between him and the Father, who he so often sought time with. Just like checking to make sure that a gold medal is truly gold, the test for humanity is to test whether we are truly image bearers of God. Are we really what the Lord says we are? So he's being tested. For those who've maybe read the Old Testament recently, you might notice some echoes of some of the first chapters. There are many parallels to the garden that Adam and Eve begin in. Of course, Adam and Eve were given a restriction of food. They were only told to not eat from this one particular tree. The serpent comes along, finds a wedge to put himself in between, and asks a kind of twisted, challenging question. Did God really say that you can't eat from any tree of the garden? If you are the Son of God, turn this stone into bread. Satan has one trick. He wedges himself between us and God. We see this in the beginning of creation. We see this in Jesus' temptation here. He's tempting us to give in to this desire for independence, to not have to depend on the God that we're created for fullness of life. He's saying, give in to your independence. Eat the fruit. Conjure the bread, Jesus. The question of the garden is, will you depend on the God who created you? Or will you take matters into your own hands? We know the rest of that story. Humanity failed the test in the garden. They chose independence, not God. So we find ourselves later on in the story in the wilderness. God rescued and blessed one nation, Israel. He recaptured this people from Egypt, bringing them through the Red Sea and into the wilderness. What do? They wandered for 40 years. And you hear the echoes of their story. Humanity again is sent into the wilderness for testing. Will you rely on the God who loves you, created you, and rescued you? Or will you choose your independence? We know again, Israel, who is called God's firstborn son, regularly worshiped other gods, complained about the food, regularly traded in renown, and put God to the test. Humanity failed the test over the 40 years in the wilderness there as well. So when we hear Jesus going into the wilderness, being tested, going without food, our ears should perk up. Something important is happening here. What is going on? Jesus is taking on the human story himself. This is why it's so important that not only is he God, but he is actually human too. He takes on our story of humanity. He enters himself into this wilderness, this place of testing, and he makes a declaration of dependence. When he resists the bread, he resists independently providing a miracle just for himself, and he trusts his Father to give him what he needs. When he resists the kingdoms of the world, if only he would worship Satan once, he's resisting shortcutting the cross, this much more painful way to gain what he needs to gain. He resists taking God's way into his own hands. Notice he doesn't resist asking to be spared. Right? We see this in the Garden of Gethsemane. Lord, if there is any other way. Depending on God does not mean that we pull up from the longings and deep desires of our hearts, but it means we lay them down at his feet. We depend on him as we hold them open-handedly. When Jesus resists jumping from the temple spire, he knew angels would catch him if he needed to. He resists the instant fame and renown of all of Jerusalem seeing who this man is. Again, shortcutting the path that he was meant to be on. Shortcutting the meek, slow, weak-seeming path that Jesus is meant to trod. Jesus, in every way, resists our regular longing for independence. And in his life, he declares the power of a dependent on God life. Everything in our culture goes against the power of a dependent life. Susan B. Anthony puts it briefly, independence is happiness. In many ways, independence, self-actualization can be a good thing, but at our core, we need to know our dependence on the God who created us. If we do not live a life of dependence, then we find ourselves regularly out on our own, pushed into nothing, as we've allowed the wedge to isolate us more and more, not only from God, but from one another. An independent life so often leaves us feeling lonely, isolated, even when we're in a room full of people that we know and love. A dependent life turns to Jesus with all of our hopes, dreams, opportunities, and waits. Our world doesn't like waiting. But this is what God calls us to. This is why every Sunday we come to the table with this posture. It's a posture of humility. This is the same posture that Jesus enters into the wilderness in. He's choosing a fast. He's foregoing a bodily need, food, for the sake of humbling himself before God so that he can hear him more clearly. David in Psalm 69, verse 10 says, I humbled my soul with fasting. Choosing a fast means depriving us of depriving ourselves of something that we need so that we can hear God more clearly and know our radical dependence on him. Richard Foster says, fasting reminds us that we are sustained by someone else. Jesus enters into the wilderness in this posture. It would be easy for us to say, look at what Jesus does. Let's be like that. And that wouldn't be all that bad. In fact, at our men's breakfast this past week, we read this passage together and just reflected on it some. I forget who said it. Somebody said, gosh, I was just thinking about what would Satan put in front of me? What would that thing be that he would put in front of me that would be successful to tempt me? I think these are beautiful spaces for us to find ourselves thinking in. But if that's where we stay, if we say, I'm going to commit more and more, I'm going to work harder along these lines, we are going to find ourselves in that same lonely, independent, isolated place that we so often find ourselves. Jesus enters into the wilderness to bring the garden back out of it. He enters into a life of dependence that ends up on a cross where he is utterly split from the presence of God, so that we would never have to know that kind of separation. Jesus lives the life that we as human beings were meant to live, that we need to live, but by this point is impossible for us to choose on our own. And he says, come, receive the work that I've done. Be dependent at God's feet again. Every other religion in the world would say, here's the path to work yourself up. Here's the way to better yourself. Even the opening parable, joke, whatever you want to call it, that version came from Psychology Today, right? We love these modern parables of thinking about how we can work our way up. But Jesus says the gospel starts in the most down place you can possibly imagine. We are dependent. And if we never receive that, any of our reflection and work that we get about doing will leave us breathless and isolated and independent. The invitation here at the start of Lent is to that humble posture, receiving the power of a dependent life. So many ways this can work itself out in our lives. But instead of giving some takeaway, take-home examples of how this could work, I wanted to give us a few minutes to sit and listen.